This is Evolutionary Radio. This is your host, Trevor Kuritzen. I also got Steve Smead joining me.
Good evening, everyone.
We also got the Mason. Matt, how are you doing?
I'm good, ready to go. What do we got for topics today?
Ready to hit it. It's Thursday night. Matt, you just got home from Halloween shopping, right?
Oh, yeah. Good times, man.
What are you dressing up as this year?
Nothing. I never do anything.
Nothing.
No, never.
I'm going as a tub of mustard, and my friend's going as ketchup. So I thought that I'm in the faculty of nutrition, right? So I thought that'd be kind of funny.
Well, you're no calories then. You're mustard.
I'm no calories. He's full of sugar. He's full of sugar and unwanted carbs. So everyone's gonna be high fiving me and not want to be associated with him.
He has high fructose corn syrup in him.
Yeah. Geez. Did you know that? In the U.S. food pyramid, ketchup is considered a vegetable.
Yeah, it's food pyramid is a nice little scam that the economists put together to kind of make sure the farmers, you know, got their money. So it's quite a scam.
Pretty depressing that, you know, giving kids ketchup in elementary school counts as giving them vegetables. Steve, are you going to dress up?
No, not even. It's funny because when I was in high school, you know what we ate for lunch? Pizza. Every day, pizza was our lunch. So yeah, that's what they. Yeah, it's bad. The nutrition situation is bad. Soda and pizza. So what can you do? You know,
like pizza or hot dogs or like chicken fingers or yeah.
It's in Canada.
Pretty much. I mean, that's... Yeah.
Matt, I thought you guys ate, like, frog legs and stuff.
No, man, that's the French. Okay, anyways, we'll get into our topics. So our first topic is wheat, gluten, and following a gluten-free diet. So this is something I've got a lot of questions on lately, and it's a really interesting topic. So 1% of the population, so basically 1 in 100 people, is actually allergic to gluten. So gluten is the protein that is in certain grains such as wheat, barley, rye, kamut. What's really interesting is when you have a food allergy to a food, what you're allergic to is the protein in that food. So someone who's allergic to peanuts, it's the protein in the peanut that he's actually allergic to. So 1% of the population actually has a food allergy to gluten or wheat. Same thing, basically. If you're allergic to gluten, you're allergic to wheat. However, 39% of people have a self-diagnosed food sensitivity to wheat and gluten. So obviously those numbers don't add up. Matt and Steve, what do you think is causing that? And then I'll tell you guys the answer.
What do you think is causing? It's the pesticides in the food, but it's also it's an inflammatory. So I think a lot of people, when they have something with gluten, soy or dairy, they'll notice their stomach gets bigger, gets inflamed, their sinuses get... We had actually on a forum talked about this. I mentioned this because a guy was complaining about his sinuses. I told him, watch what you're eating, because if you're eating something inflammatory, it's going to inflame your sinuses. A lot of these people with asthma and breathing problems... A part of it is what they're putting in their body is actually causing inflammation in their body. So stop eating stuff or drinking stuff that is causing inflammation.
Matt, what do you think it is?
I don't know. I was going to say maybe the way the food is so processed now, but I mean, I guess things like bread have been around forever. So I don't know. That's my closest guess. The amount of processed crap we eat.
It's Roundup. That's basically what it is. So here in North America, 1 week before harvest, farmers drench the wheat grain in Roundup because it leads to basically a higher crop yield. So a lot of people with wheat sensitivities aren't actually sensitive to the wheat. They're sensitive to the Roundup that's drenched on the wheat. So what's really interesting is a lot of people with wheat sensitivities here in North America, they go to Europe, they can eat bread with no problems. So that's basically what's actually causing that huge stomach distress. It's the Roundup. Obviously Roundup's extremely toxic. So that's what's causing it. So it's really, really interesting. So I personally recommend consuming a gluten-free diet. Most people will feel a lot better on a gluten-free diet. And the main reason is because of the Roundup. I don't know if, did you guys know that, Steve and Matt?
Yeah, I said that. I said pesticide, but Roundup is an herbicide. But yeah, I mean, go get some Roundup from the store and drink it and see how you feel after that. I'm pretty sure everyone would agree that these herbicides and pesticides are not good to be consumed. I would hope people think that, but a lot of people are pigheaded, you know, and they don't want to listen. But what else were you saying? I was going to bring up another point.
The average North American will consume 160 pounds of Roundup in their lifetime.
Yeah, I mean, that's not surprising. But it's in our water, too.
It's in everything, man. It's scary. It's like chemical warfare.
The farming industry is so powerful that, you know, they're going to continue to poison us. There's really nothing we can do about it. We're slaves. So
all you can really do is buy organic. But even then with organic foods, they're beside each other in the grocery store. So there is still going to be some cross contamination. Your best bet is to try to find, you know, like a local farmer or grow your own vegetables. More and more people are doing that. You know, they're kind of having, you know, small gardens in their apartment and they're doing hypotonic growing. So that would be the best option. You know, that's something I've thought about getting into is, you know, making my own little garden in my apartment. Matt, what are your thoughts? And we'll go into our next topic.
Well, I think Steve was getting into it with how powerful the farming industry is. We've talked about this with the pharmaceutical companies. The reason why, you know, cancer, one of the reasons it hasn't had a, you know, a set cure is because that takes the money out of it, right? These companies want to prescribe drugs. So I can speak, hopefully none of my colleagues listen, but you guys know I work for a bread company that happens to be the biggest baking company in the world.
Matt's a trader.
It's in 29 countries. It's a massive company. Okay. And the second biggest company in Canada has joined forces and they've together created something called the Healthy Grains Institute. So if you ever hear of this Healthy Grains Institute, it would be all over North America. Basically, what they do is they put out things in the media, social media, TV, studies showing how healthy bread is, how healthy grains are, and how anybody that's worried about gluten is just being worried for no reason. Unless you're sensitive to gluten, there's no problem. There's no reason to worry. So this just shows you when big, powerful companies, when there is something going on, they'll do everything they can, including work together with their rival to make sure people aren't aware of things that are actually going on.
Steve, you got anything to chime in before we move to our next topic?
Well, I mean, I think that, listen, on one hand, you can look at it that way. On the other, you can look at it as it's amazing how we still have people that go to bed hungry. 20-25% of people in North America, children, go to bed hungry. So even though they're drenching the crops with all this shit to try to get more food, there's still people going to bed hungry. So this argument that we should do that to get more food is bullshit. And the government actually pays farmers to destroy their crops because that keeps the prices up so that the farmers basically can actually make a living at it. Because so many farmers make a living at farming and the prices are so low that it's a, you know, there's no inflation in food. So the government has to actually inflate prices by eliminating food so that the farmers can actually, you know, sell enough crops to actually buy other things that they want, like cars and houses and other stuff. So it's an economic issue, and it's a really lose-lose situation for everybody in the end. Even the farmers get screwed in the end.
So let's move on to our second topic. Our second topic is favorite injection sites. This is actually a topic that I myself am bringing up. I've been doing my testosterone replacement therapy shots in my quads the last 3-4 years, I guess. Basically, I alternate between right quad, left quad, right quad, left quad. It's only one injection per week, but my quads are basically telling me I've had enough. Glutes, for whatever reason, for me, I get a huge amount of post-injection pain from it. What do Steve and then Matt, what are some of your guys' favorite sites? I'm looking to use some new sites. I don't need like that big of a site because I'm only injecting 1 mil. So what would you recommend for a 1 mil shot?
Pecs and delts. Both pecs are easy to inject. And then the left delt is really easy to inject. If you're right-handed into the left delt, no problem. Either, you know, if you're right-handed, you can hit your right pec or left pec. Those are the easiest injections.
I hear pec all the time. Where exactly in your pec do you inject?
Just flex your muscle and then just find, like, you know, the quadrant of your pec that's the highest, and then you can hit it there. So it'd be like kind of maybe an inch over your nipple and then maybe 2 inches toward the center.
So for our listeners, I'm showing Steve my pec and my nipple on our webcam. So Steve, I'm basically flexing my chest here.
Okay.
So basically you see my nipple. So I basically would just go directly up an inch and inject like where my finger is.
And then more to the middle.
More to the middle. Okay.
Yes. Right there. Yeah. The peak.
So for our listeners, basically, I basically put my finger on my nipple. I went up towards my chin an inch, and then I went towards the inside of my body an inch. So I basically did a 90 degree angle from my nipple. So basically you go up about an inch from your nipple, then you go towards your body about an inch. What would you say volume-wise for pecs? Up to 2 milliliters?
Oh, I've done 3 even in the pecs. It's a big muscle. But yeah, you know, 2 is good.
Okay, so like right now I'm flexing. You want to do it unflexed, right? So you basically want to
sanitize
your pec, yeah. Totally relax your pec, and then do the injection?
Exactly, yep. Very easy.
Okay, that's interesting.
Or the delt is really easy.
Side delts I've done. I don't know. I'm kind of iffy on side delts. Matt, have you ever done pecs? Pecs really interest me.
No, I've never done pecs. I've done delts before. I was going to say that would be the easy one. But there's a few guys that can hit that ventral glute spot on the side. No, I've never done it, but I've heard it's really easy to find. And when you do it, you'll have no pain ever. It's like the least pip of any site you could have. So that might be one to try. I've seen videos where standing still, you basically just lift your leg up to the side and it makes it really easy to see the spot. So that might be, you know, another one you could try too.
So you basically do like a side lateral raise with your leg to find it?
Yes.
Okay. So yep. Basically
there was like a video, a YouTube video I saw.
So let's say I was going to do my right side. I'd basically put all the weight in my left leg and then I would do a side lateral raise with my right leg to find it. Is that correct?
Yes. Once you lift it up, you'll see where the muscle is, where you want to go.
So Matt, you're on TRT. Where do you do your TRT shots?
I always do glutes. I've never had a problem reaching. I've never had any pain. So I just rotate. That's the way I've always done it. I think quads at all.
I think my issue is I'm so lean, and that's why I get the post-injection pain from the glutes. I don't know why. Just I know everyone recommends glutes, and for like 99% of people, Same thing. But I've had clients, and when they're like 3 or 4 weeks out from their show, they say the same thing, that the glutes really causes post-injection pain. So I think when you get like to a point of leanness, then, you know, injecting your glutes might cause a bunch of inflammation. Steve, I see you want to chime in.
Well, I wanted to ask Matt, are you using a mirror when you're doing your glute?
No.
So no, I mean, how do you see, you know, what you're hitting? You kind of like just look behind you?
So the way that I learned how to do it is where I place my hand. So it's kind of hard without having video to, you know, to properly explain it. But basically, if you stand up straight and you're going to put your hand on your hip, you would have your hand fully extended. So your thumb would be up in the air on your hip bone. So when you do that, your hand is straight. And then all you want to do is take your index finger and just slide it back, and where it rests will end up right in that upper outer quadrant. So I always do like kind of a quick measurement right to where it is. And then when I wipe it off to clean it, I can feel where that spot is. So then I just go right in there. I don't need to see it anymore. It just takes time. And then, you know, it's second nature.
Okay. Interesting. Steve, do you want to introduce our third topic?
Sure. Let's see here. I have one that was posted on the forums that was really good, and I don't think really it got enough attention, but it was a really good one. And a guy was asking, he hasn't used steroids or worked out in 10 years, and he wants to know what has changed in the past 10 years when it comes to steroid use, supplements, and working out in general. And, you know, let me just say, first of all, when it comes to working out, what's interesting is a lot of gyms in the past 10 years have closed and a lot of gyms have opened. I would say there's more gyms now than there was 10 years ago, but it's different. It's like Planet Fitness, LA Fitness, those franchise gyms are more plentiful today. And then the kind of the mom and pop gyms, the large mom and pop gyms that are kind of by themselves are like closed. So it seems like, you know, the whole, you know, wanting to open up your own gym and is just not financially possible, you know? So I think that's what's changed in the past 10 years. So if you want to find a gym, you know, that's close by, you may have to end up going with like a shitty ass Planet Fitness or LA Fitness, because a lot of the good bomb and pop gyms have disappeared in the past 10 years because these other places can charge 10 or 15 or 20 a month membership, and the mom and pop places just can't afford to stay open. Also, another thing that's happened in the past 10 years is CrossFit gyms have exploded. There's been a lot of CrossFit gyms opening now. Compared to 10 years ago, it seems to be every other person now wants to open their own CrossFit gym. So in terms of gyms, that's been the big change that I've noticed in the past decade. I'm curious to hear what you guys think about the supplement. Trevor, on your end, how supplements have changed, and Matt, on your end, how steroids have changed in the past 10 years.
Well, this is a really good topic for me to speak on, because I started weight training when I was about 13 or 14, and now I'm 25. So basically that 10-year time frame, it really resonates for me, because everyone remembers when they started working out and to where we are today. So when I started working out, you know, I did it by myself. You know, I basically just bought like a Weider encyclopedia of exercises that showed all the exercises. And what was really cool about that book is every single exercise was a free weight exercise. So I started training 10 years ago, not using machines at all. Like, I didn't even use a leg extension. I didn't even use leg press. I didn't use any of that, because basically I bought this book. And I would, you know, look at the leg exercises and I would just copy the photos. And I remember being at that YMCA and seeing a lot of people doing the same exercises as me. You know, everyone was squatting, bench pressing, deadlifting. There wasn't that many machines. There's lots of cardio equipment, but there really wasn't that much machines in any of the gyms I was at. You know, it was pretty much free weights. You would have like a leg press, you would have like some cables. And then in like the group exercise rooms, you'd have things like kettlebells and, you know, Bosu balls and things like that. But there weren't a lot of machines. Fast forward today, if you go into any gym, it's almost all machines, you know, and very little free weights. And the free weights they do have, it's mostly Smith machines, you know. So if you go in the gym today, most people are using machines and no one's actually lifting weights anymore. Supplements, the supplements that work haven't changed. I mean, 10 years ago, there was protein powder, there was creatine, there's, you know, like fish oil, multivitamins, things like that. If you look at the supplements, you know, we recommend, it's the same supplements that have been around, you know, the last 10 years. What's really come onto the market lately are pre-workouts, nitric oxide boosters, things like that. Kind of like the Pixie Dux supplements that don't really do anything but have a really good markup. And that's why, you know, supplement companies push them so hard. Because, I mean, pre-workouts, when it really comes down to it, what is it? It's a caffeine drink. And you know how cheap caffeine is. I mean, you can buy a jar of caffeine pills for like $2-3. So that's why, you know, all these supplement companies and all these supplement stores are pushing these pre-workouts, is because the markup on them is so good. As for nutrition, same thing. I mean, what worked 10 years ago is still what works. Nowadays, though, I feel like people are eating less food and are eating more food-like products. You know, 10 years ago, I saw people drinking protein shakes, but I never really saw people eating like protein bars or protein cookies or protein muffins or anything like that. You know, and I remember being a young kid, I would go to the guys at the gym and, you know, ask them like, hey, what'd you eat for breakfast today? What'd you eat for lunch today? And they would always say, you know, breakfast, they would have like egg whites and oatmeal. And then for lunch, they would have, you know, like fish and rice or chicken and rice or something like it was very, very basic. But nowadays, you know, when you see most people walking into the gym, they're not eating an apple, they're eating a protein bar, or, you know, they're eating some protein cookie, or they're, so that's what I've really seen changed is, you know, it seems like we're almost all as a society getting away from the basics and are getting more and more into these quick fix type things. Matt, what have you really seen change the last 10 years?
Oh man, the number one thing that's changed is social media. Social media is huge now. That's where everything is. So all of a sudden everybody's got a YouTube channel and an Instagram, you know, fitness account and everything else. So, you know, everybody's just following like sheep, all these people. And in the end, you know, most of their goal is just to sell you their product or their workout program. So that's the way, it's the way that we consume and the way that we learn is so different. That's the biggest thing by far. As far as Steve was bringing up steroids, like the biggest thing I find now is because they're so cheap and they're so easy to make, everybody's making them. So, you know, how do you survive as a business? Well, you end up making shittier quality because you can sell so much before people catch on. So I think in general, the quality is so much worse now, but at the same time, it's so easy to get. You know, like when Steve and I first started out, you couldn't just go online and put your credit card number in and get steroids to your door, like basically like you can now. You know, you had to know somebody in the gym or, you know who you could talk to. And it was a lot harder to get, but the quality was a lot better. As far as the compounds, it's the same stuff. You know, what worked then is what works now. You know, maybe, you know, there's been some advancements in things like anti-estrogen drugs and post-cycle therapies, things like that. But the actual steroids, what worked then works now. Testosterone works now just like it did then. It's just as good. So I think it's a lot of the background stuff, a lot of the lifestyle things. If we really want to compare, I would say the biggest, most important changes really are the diet. The diet has changed, you know, more than any other aspect. So I think that's probably the most important part.
I'm going to play devil's advocate a little bit on the steroid section, and then we'll let Steve chime in, and then he can introduce the fourth topic. I agree with you that not much has really changed in terms of steroids. What has changed is now that SARMs are available, and that has totally changed, you know, PCT. It's totally changed, you know, options for females. You know, I would argue 95% of the people in a gym could get the results they're looking for just from SARMs. You know, like steroids now aren't even necessary unless you really want to do bodybuilding. And most people don't want to be a bodybuilder. You know, they just want to have a lean, athletic, muscular build. And I mean, with a smart diet and training approach and, you know, just some SARMs, they can easily achieve the body they're looking for. What's really changed in terms of steroids? I mean, 10 years ago, people were using Test, Deca, D-ball. Now people are still using Test, Deca, and D-ball. What's really changed is the accessibility. I mean, now you just Google buy steroids online. You have 50 different websites you can choose from. I mean, you go to Western Union, you send some guys some money. 2 days later, you got a tracking number. A week later, you got, you know, your gear, some syringes, and you're ready to rock. So what's really changed is the accessibility. And with steroids being so easy to order, people are using steroids way too soon and people are using them way younger. You know, my first couple of years training, I didn't even know what steroids were. Like, it just wasn't something people talked about. But now people talk about it, you know, like at the water fountain, almost as if it's like not even illegal. You know, like it blows my mind. Like I hear guys in between sets and they're talking about their cycles. They're talking about like it's nothing. Like it's now like common talk. It's like talking about what supplements you're taking. Steve, I'll let you finish up this topic.
Don't forget forums. Forums have changed a lot. 10 years ago, Elite mm-hmm. Fitness was the biggest fitness forum. If you went on Elite Fitness and you posted a thread asking for a steroid source, you got banned instantly. There was like zero tolerance for that shit. Like it was one of those things where, you know, you could kind of, you know, ask about it, but like you'd have to kind of do it like under the radar. You couldn't be like open about it. And you'd have to kind of like be, you know, on the forum for a while, have a certain number of posts. Like if you have like 20 posts and then you message someone about, you know, where can I get steroids? You know, they ban you. It's like, how dare you do that? Now, there's so many fitness forums that you can go on and you can ask, find sources. There's reviews on sources. It's like fucking shopping for a fucking purse on Amazon. There's reviews on sources, you know, like 5-star, 4-star, 3-star reviews. You can have one post and then start a thread asking, hey, I need a source. You know where I can get this, you know where I can get that. And everyone is, you know, cool with it. So things have changed a lot when it comes to forums, and it's made the accessibility very easy. But I have seen there was a peak in that maybe a year or two ago, and it's kind of dropped off because all these forums kind of ate each other up, and all these underground labs kind of ate each other up. A lot of them got busted. A lot of them just had such shitty gear that they built bad reputations. So it's kind of been a cycle that kind of peaked a year or two ago. Now it's coming back down. So it'd be interesting to see where we are in 10 years.
Steve, you can introduce our fourth topic now.
We had another forum thread that was really good too. He wanted to know, I think it's a really good question because this is something a lot of people are kind of scared to talk about, but you know, let's discuss it a little bit. He wants to know, should he have sex or work out first? So basically, you know, does working out kind of affect sex, and does sex affect working out? And I guess I'll talk about this first.
Steve, you go, and then I'll go, and we'll let Matt go last because he's married, so he hasn't had sex in 10 years.
I thought you were going to say he's married, so he has sex all the time. Because some people think that. The younger guys think that people get married to have sex, but like...
Well, okay. Once you're married, you'll probably still have sex regularly. Once you have kids, though, then like it's you pretty much might as well just throw your condoms out, yeah, or give them to a friend, because you're gonna have to wear them anymore. Matt's body ingredients. Yeah. You can't see Matt on the webcam here, guys, but he's basically nodding and giving that shoot himself signal. So, okay, Steve,
you want to go? Yeah, in all seriousness, I would say the thing about it is it depends. Okay, like first of all, it depends on your workout. If your workouts are like very easy and they don't drain you. If sex is very easy and it doesn't drain you, like for some guys, sex is like 30 seconds. It's like two humps and they're done. All right. For others, it's like an hour. All right. So it just depends. And the same thing with working out. Like if you're going to go work out and work your legs and do like fucking 20 sets of squats and do 10 sets of lunges, I mean, like, you know, do like a bunch of lunges going around the gym like three times, you're going to be so worn out that I don't know how you're going to be able to have sex. I mean, so it just depends on the situation. I would say, you know, it's possible to do both. I mean, I've done both. Either way, I've worked out, then had sex, or had sex, then worked out. I would say have sex first, because I'd say you want to be fresh for that. You want to have, you know, the workout comes second, because like I tell the guy on the forum, if you're not banging the shit out of your wife or girlfriend and doing it the right way, all right, then she's going to go and find that personal trainer in the gym instead and let him bang her the right way. So you better fucking bang her the right way and use up all your energy on her. Then whatever you have left over, you know, go have a meal, go hydrate, and then you can go work out and get in your workout for the day. But I've actually had some of my best workouts after sex. There's just something like where it releases your hormones or something. But, you know, I like to get in a meal in between to kind of, you know, fill up my glycogen levels again. And definitely hydrate for sure. It's important.
Okay. So there's a lot of like bro science about ejaculation and testosterone levels. Like a lot of guys are scared to have sex or masturbate near their workouts because they think it lowers testosterone levels or it's going to cause less gains or something. Like, no. Like ejaculating does not affect muscle growth in any sort of way. That being said, sex is like a workout. I mean, like it's basically a cardio workout. So I mean, it'd be the equivalent of going for like an hour jog before your workout. It's not that sex negatively impacted your muscle building potential. You just did an hour of cardio. So you're going to be a little bit fatigued. You're going to be a little bit tired before your workout. That's all it is. You know, it'd be the exact same thing as doing an hour of cardio before your workout. So whether you should have sex first, whether you should work out first, depends on your goals. I mean, if your goal is to have a really good workout and you really don't care that much about the chick, work out first, make that your priority, and then you're going to be a little bit energy drained for the sex. If making that girl, you know, if rocking her world is your first priority, have sex first, but then know that your workout's going to suffer a little bit because you're not going to have as much energy. So that's basically it in a nutshell. There's no real magic to it. It's kind of just whichever is your main priority, do that first. Matt, go ahead.
Yeah, I think like the guy is really, really looking at this way too seriously. Like I've learned you take what you can get. When you can get it, you take it. And that's it. It doesn't matter if you're going to work out. Like I can't imagine saying, can we have sex now? Because I have to work out. And I kind of want to get it over with so that way I get enough time to get a meal in before I go to lift. I can't imagine saying that. And at the same time, I also can't imagine coming home and saying, you know, honey, can we have sex tomorrow maybe because it's an off day? I'm a little tired from the gym. So I think like Matt, you just take it when you can get it.
My ex-girlfriend's in.
Oh, God.
That's something I would say.
You just take it when you can get it. You know what? And if your workout suffers a little bit, you know, whatever. How much is it going to suffer? It's negligible. You know, if you have sex and you go to the gym, yes, you did your cardio, but you know what? Suck it up. Power through your workout. You're probably going to be in a good mood anyways. So just push through. I think, you know, the workout always comes second. It has to, unfortunately.
So our next topic is a really good topic. It's basically omega-3 fatty acids. We got a really good listener question. I'm not going to read the whole question because it's a page long, but basically he wants to know fish oil, krill oil, seal oil, which is the best, how much should I use, all that sort of stuff. So the first thing I'll say is that the three of them all have their benefits and all are slightly different. So fish oil, that's kind of your basic bread and butter omega-3 supplement. It has EPA and DHA. It's the least expensive of the three, very widely accessible. You can get that at Costco. That's where I get mine. You can get the best prices there. Krill oil. So krill oil is like fish, but krill is basically minnows. It's little fish. So it's kind of like comparing broccoli to broccoli sprouts. Both are healthy foods, but the broccoli sprouts is going to provide a little bit more nutrients. So the krill oil, it has some extra antioxidant benefits and extra, it's better at lowering cholesterol levels than just fish oil. Seal oil, what's cool about seal oil is fish oil and krill oil, they have EPA and DHA, but mammal sources of omega-3 fatty acids have an additional essential omega-3 fatty acid called DPA that's only found in mammal sources of fat, basically like seal oil. So what I recommend is, you know, for a man, your fish oil, you'd want to get about 6 grams of that, krill oil, about 2 grams of that per day, and then seal oil, about 2 grams of that per day. That's best case. For a woman, you'd basically just take those numbers and divide them in half. So for a woman, 3 grams of fish oil, 1 gram of krill oil, 1 gram of seal oil. If you can't afford the krill and the seal, just get the fish and then do 10 grams as a man, 6 grams as a 5 grams as a female. You're probably thinking 10 fish oil pills. That seems like a lot. Not really, because each pill is 1 gram. That's a fifth of a teaspoon. You know, if you were to measure out a fifth of a teaspoon, and I'm saying teaspoon, not tablespoon, teaspoon of olive oil, you could barely see that with the naked eye, right? So, I mean, 10 grams of fish oil, that's 2/3 of a tablespoon, is really not much fat. Steve,
but Trevor, how many calories are in those fish oil, though?
9 calories. 1 gram of fat has 9 calories. So 10 fish oil pills would have 90 calories.
Right. So, I mean, you know, 90 calories isn't that much, I guess, you know, in the grand scheme of things.
And no, it's pretty negligible. It's kind of like worrying
it's like a banana, basically.
No, a banana has about 120. It's like a very, very small banana.
So, you know, omega-3s and omega-6s are two different things. Omega-6s, the problem in our diets, we have too many omega-6s. And this is something, like, let's say, you know, potato chips, popcorn, basically anything in a bag, it's got omega-6s because it's got the safflower oil, sunflower oil, canola oil, all that shit. Chicken and you know, that you buy from any restaurant or from fast food or whatever, they put canola oil in it because they vegetable oil because they want that shit to taste good. So in American diets, we get so many omega-6s and we don't get any omega-3s. So you really have to basically balance that out. And I'm not saying, you know, not to get any omega-6s, but geez, we get so much of it that it's not like you have to go and fucking drink vegetable oil or canola oil to get enough. So you really have to make sure you're getting more omega-3s than you are omega-6s, especially with our diets, because we already get so many omega-6s, it's ridiculous. And this is really, really, you know, destroying our health. There's a reason, before Trevor, you say anything, let me tell you something. There's a reason that heart disease is the number one killer. And that is one of them, you know, for sure. What were you going to say?
Well, I was basically just going to say what the different fat roles are in the body. So omega-6s are involved in inflammation, and then omega-3s are anti-inflammatory. So some inflammation is needed. So like Steve said, you know, it's not like you want zero omega-3s because you actually need inflammation. You know, that's omega what causes six. The that's omega what causes six. A muscle pump. That's what, like, some inflammation is needed, but we have too much. A perfect ratio would be a 1-to-1 omega-3 to omega-6 ratio, because then your inflammation and your anti-inflammatory is balanced. The problem is most of us here in North America, we're getting a 20-to-1 omega-6 to omega-3 ratio, and that's why we're all so inflamed. Matt, I'll let you finish up this topic, and then you can introduce our last topic.
Okay, so when I heard we were going to talk about this one, I grabbed my fish oil. So I got the one that I take right next to me here. And what you guys want to do is make sure you read your labels. So in this product I have here, each pill, each capsule is 1 gram of fish oil. But what we really want to be concerned about is the EPA and DHA within that fish oil. The rest is just going to be filler. So in this one here, out of the gram, I have 720 milligrams are EPA and DHA combined. So 72%. So that's pretty good. If you're in that range, you're in good shape. What you don't want is something that's going to be, you know, 50%, 30% EPA, DHA. That's going to be pretty crappy. So be careful where you're spending your money, because that's where you're going to get the benefits from. So what I do, I take 8 capsules of this per day. So if you're taking 8, don't think you're getting 8 grams of fish oil. Really, you're getting between 5 and 6. So that's my tip on how to dose them properly. You really have to look at those two things in there. I do also take krill oil. I think if you can afford it, krill oil, I do like a little bit better. And that's more for the environmental aspect. There's no risk of overfishing with krill like there is with fish. In this product that I have, it's made up of anchovy, sardine, and mackerel. So you want to be environmentally conscious when you can be, and that's where krill
is actually 100 times worse for the environment.
Not what I read. I have an article out on evolutionary.org where I went through the krill versus the fish oil. So that's what I go by.
It's way worse because you're taking out basically 100 baby fish instead of 1 adult fish.
Well, the way I understood it is krill are actually not fish. They're crustaceans, from what I thought.
Correct, but...
There's so many of them population-wise.
It'd be another topic in itself, but krill would be way worse for the environment. But actually, that being said, most fish oil and most krill oil, the krill oil is actually farmed. Like, they actually farm the crustaceans. And then the fish oil, they're using things like anchovies and sardines, which aren't endangered species. So it's neither are really an issue, but krill oil is actually way worse for the environment. But okay, anyways, you can finish.
No, that's good info. It's good when we don't always agree on everything. So yeah, that's it on the fish oil. I guess why don't we move on to the last topic then? We got another steroid topic for you guys. And this is kind of just a debate that gets thrown out there. Is Anavar just a weak steroid that should be used by females, or is it worth the high price you actually pay for it? So I know everybody will have a difference in opinion, and there's so many factors that go along with this because, you know, your diet and your training are so important. I think for most people, it's not the best bang for your buck, because what people end up doing is they spend so much money on Anavar, and then they want to run, you know, 80 or 100 milligrams per day. If you have legit Anavar and you have your training good and your diet good, you don't need that much. You don't need more than, you know, 40, 50 milligrams per day. So I think for a regular gym rat, you're probably better off to not use Anavar, to go with something maybe, you know, like T-ball or D-ball, depending on your goals. It is high priced, but if you have everything the way that it should be, I think it's very effective. So I wouldn't say it's only a female steroid. I would just say it's not my favorite for a gym rat that, you know, doesn't have everything absolutely dialed in.
I'll go and then let Steve finish, because Steve's the steroid guru, so I know he'll have a lot to comment on. I think Anavar is extremely underrated. I would say it's probably one of the best steroids on the market. The problem with Anavar is so much Anavar on the black market is fake or underdosed. So most people who think they're using, you know, a 20 milligram pill of Anavar are probably using like a 5 milligram pill, or they're not even using Anavar at all. Anavar just gives you really clean, cosmetic, nice gains. It's not very liver toxic. It's not that like you're not going to get lethargy on Anavar. If you can get a good source of Anavar and you can run as a man about 60 milligrams per day, it will be one of your favorite steroids. It's not going to cause a lot of bloat or immediate strength or anything like that. It's basically like a pretty boy steroid. It's like a men's physique steroid, but it will just give your body that really nice cosmetic aesthetic look. Everything will be round, popping, but you're not going to retain any water. It's a great, great steroid. The problem is finding a legitimate source. 95% of Anavar on the market is crap. Steve, we'll let you finish up the show here.
I would encourage everyone to try both. In my experience, I got similar results from both. I hit PRs on both, stacking both with Tren. So they both really were good to me. I think they're both awesome, T-Ball and Anavar. T-Ball is like half the price. So, I mean, you know, for me, I've used T-Ball more than Anavar. So, you know, I like Proviron as well, but Proviron is very different in both of these compounds. But Proviron is a great one to use as part of a stack as well. So those three are really good, and I would be utilizing them in your cycles. The nice thing about Proviron over that's advantageous to both T-Ball and Anavar is that it's liver safe. So, you know, that's the advantage of Proviron. But I would definitely experiment with all three of these. The thing, all three of them, they don't aromatize into estrogen, so I'm not going to give you any of those issues at all. And their side effects are very low. They're very, you know, they're very solid steroids and they make a great stack.
A really simple oral only stack you could run that'll give you really good results, and it won't be too expensive, would be to stack T-Ball, Anavar, and Proviron. So T-Ball normally comes in 25 milligram tablets. So you basically take one of those per day. Proviron normally comes in 25 milligram tablets. You take one of those per day. And then Anavar normally comes in 10 milligrams. So you take two of those per day. So basically 25 milligrams T-Ball, 20 milligrams Anavar, 25 milligrams Proviron. That'll give you a really good oral-only cycle that'll be pretty cost-effective and give you really good results. You'd obviously get a lot more out of it if you stack it with a testosterone base. But I mean, for those people who just want to do an oral only cycle, that's a cycle I often recommend. You get really, really good results. Matt and then Steve, do you have any closing remarks before I close up the show?
I think that's an interesting stack. I've never thought of that. Never heard that one before. I was wondering where you were going to go with it, with Anavar and T-Ball both being mild anabolics, but I get it now. You throw the Proviron in there, that's your androgen. So I think that could be a great stack. I think, you know, depending on the person, if you had to, you could even go up to 50 milligrams per day on the Proviron if you needed more of a kick and not really have any more risk as far as, you know, it's obviously not liver toxic. It's not going to give you any more side effects. So that's interesting. I think that's something you could play with.
I train quite a few models and, you know, guys who are, you know, looking to compete in like men's physique. And, you know, the thing about models is they're always traveling. So for them, injectables are just kind of a pain in the butt because they're traveling, you know, multiple days per week. So I recommend a cycle similar to that to them. And they're not, again, like they're not looking to put on 20, 30 pounds. They're just looking for the cosmetic effect, you know, maybe gain a couple pounds, you know, just have a really nice, dry, lean cut appearance to their physique. And everyone I recommended that stack has loved it. No one has said any complaints whatsoever. Steve, what are your closing remarks?
That's actually a good topic for our next show, traveling with steroids, because I'm curious how they do that.
They're traveling domestically.
Well, even that, like, because you could get pulled over and, you know, a cop could see that you have.
Yeah, there is risk involved. I mean, if you're traveling domestically, normally they won't search you. And if they do search you, they'll just search your check bag. But whenever you're traveling, when you pay for that ticket and you sign it, you basically say they have the permission to do anything they want. So, I mean, if they want to, they can strip search you. They can literally do anything they want. So, I mean, traveling with steroids is a huge risk, and that's a great topic. We'll definitely do that on our next episode.
No, I mean, if you carry it on, they're going to put it through the X-ray machine and stuff. And so if they open it, they pick you out to open it up just by chance. Yeah, your checked luggage, they wouldn't check. So that's a good one to talk about.
You'd basically put it in like Tylenol bottles or something like that.
Don't spoil it.
We'll talk about it. But what's really interesting is people think I know all of this stuff because my dad, he's a pastor and he specializes in addictions and people who are drug addicts. People think that a drug dog can sniff every single drug, right? They think that this drug dog has this magic nose that can smell all of these different smells. You can only train a drug dog to pick up one or two drug smells. It's a dog, right? It's not that smart. So basically, what do they care about? Cocaine and heroin. So any drug dog at the airport doesn't know how to smell for testosterone. They don't know how to smell for Anavar. They know how to smell for either, you know, weed, meth, coke, ecstasy, heroin, things like that. And then if you look, you'll see that most drug units, they have multiple dogs. That's why, is because each dog is only trained for two different drugs. So that's why they need to have multiple dogs. Any, I kind of went on a tyrant here. Any last things, or and then I'll close up the show.
I have to disagree with you about dogs not being smarter. I think they're smarter than a lot of people.
Okay. Well, you know what I meant. I mean, like, their sense of smell isn't that acute. Let's put it that way.
Yeah, I know. I'm just messing with you. All right. Yeah, that show went by quick. If you guys have any other questions, make sure you send them in. We'll answer them.
Yeah, I mean, if you guys have any questions, you can always go on evolutionary.org, post up a thread. It'll get answered in literally hours. You know, Steven, myself, and Matt were on there every single day answering questions. It's been another great episode. We appreciate you guys constantly listening and emailing us all these great questions. For your host, Trevor Caritzen, for my co-host, Steve Smee, and for my second co-host, Matt, also known as Masonic Bodybuilder, on the forums, this has been another episode of Evolutionary Radio. Live your life. Look good doing it. Thanks for listening. Thank you.